streets, past one set of ruins after another, but his direction was sure. The encircling Aiel moved on their toes. Their eyes above the black veils did not look as if they expected attack, but as if the attack had already begun. The unseen watchers and broken buildings brought back memories Rand would as soon have avoided. Here Matt had begun a road that took him to the Horn of Valir, that almost killed him on the way. Maybe the road that had led him to Ruidian and the Turangreal he did not want to talk about. Here Perrin had disappeared when they were all forced to flee in the night, and when Rand finally saw him again, far from here, he had golden eyes and a sad look and secrets that Moraine had never shared with Rand. He had not escaped unscathed himself, though Shadar Logoth had not touched him directly. Padan Fain had followed them all here, himself and Matt and Perrin, Moraine and Lan, Nynaeve and Egwene. Padan Fain, peddler, and frequent visitor to the Two Rivers. Padan Fain, dark friend. More than dark friend now, and worse, so Moraine had said. Fain had followed them all here, but what left was more than Fain, or less. Fain, as much as he was still Fain, wanted Rand dead. He had threatened everyone Rand loved if Rand would not come to him. And Rand had not. Perrin had dealt with that, kept the Two Rivers safe, but light how it hurt. What had Fain been doing with the White Cloaks? Could Pedro Nile be a dark friend? If Aes Sedai could be, then so could the Lord Captain Commander of the Children of the Light.
There it is,
Hammond said, and Rand gave a start. Shadar Logoth was the last place on earth to lose yourself in thought. Where the Elder stood had been a spacious square once, though a weathered mound of rubble filled one end now. In the middle of the square, where a fountain might have been, was instead an ornate filigree fence of some shiny metal, ogier high and untouched by rust. That enclosed what appeared to be a tall length of stone, carved with vines and leaves, so delicately done that you expected to feel the breeze that was riffling them, that you were surprised to realize they were gray, not green. The way gate, though it certainly looked like no kind of gate.
They cut down the grove as soon as the ogier departed for the Stetting,
Hammond muttered angrily, long brows drawn down.
No more than 20 or 30 years, and extended the city.
Rand touched the fence with a flow of air, wondering how to get through, and blinked as the whole thing collapsed into 20 or more pieces, which fell with loud shivering clangs that made the ogier jump. Rand shook his head. Of course. Metal that had survived so long without a spot of rust must be power wrought, maybe even remnants from the Age of Legends. But the joins that had held them together had long since corroded, awaiting one good shove. Kovril laid a hand on his shoulder.
I would ask you not to open it. No doubt Loyal told you how. He always did show too much interest in that sort of thing, but the ways are dangerous.
I can lock it, Ammon said, so it cannot be opened again without the Talisman of Growing. A simple matter, simply done.
He did not seem eager, though. He certainly did not move any closer. It might have to be used without time for fetching anything, Rand told him. All the ways might have to be used, whatever the dangers. If he could cleanse them somehow, that was almost as grandiose as his boast to Taim that he would cleanse Saidin. He began weaving Saidin around the way gate, using all 5 powers, even lifting the segments of fence back into place. From the first flow he channeled, the taint seemed to pulse inside him, a slow building vibration. It must have been the evil in Shadar Logoth itself, a resonance of evil to evil. Even in the void he felt dizzy from those reverberations, as though the world swung beneath his feet in time to them. They made him want to vomit up everything he had ever eaten. Still he persevered. He could not send men to stand guard here any more than he could have had them search. What he wove, and then inverted, was a vicious sort of trap to suit a vicious place. a ward of surpassing nastiness. Humans could cross it unharmed, perhaps even the Forsaken. He could ward against humans or Shadowspawn, not both. And even a male Forsaken could not detect it. Should any sort of Shadowspawn pass through, that was the viciousness. They would not die right away. They might even live to make it beyond the city walls. Long enough for the dead to be far off, not here to frighten the next Murdrall that came. Long enough for a Trolloc army to exit, perhaps, picking up their own deaths as they did. Cruel enough for a Trolloc. Making the thing sickened him as much as the taint on Cydene. Tying off the weave and loosing Cydene brought only some relief. The residue of filth that always seemed to remain behind still throbbed. It almost felt as though the ground were throbbing beneath his boots. His teeth and ears ached. He could not wait to get away from here. Taking a deep breath, he prepared to channel again to open a gateway, and stopped, frowning. Quickly he counted everyone, then did it again, more slowly. "Somebody's missing. Who?" The Aiel took only a moment to confer.
"Liar," Sulin said through her veil. "She was right behind me."
There was no mistaking Jelani's voice.
"Maybe she saw something." He thought that was Desora.
"I told everyone to stay together." Rage washed across the void, waves breaking to froth on a boulder. One of them missing, here. And they took it with that light-blasted Aiel coolness. A maiden missing, a woman missing, in Shaddaa Logoth. "When I find her..." Inch by inch, he fought down the fury that threatened to engulf the emptiness around him. What he wanted to do to Lyra was shout at her till she fainted, send her to Sora Lea for the rest of her life. That rage wanted white-hot murder. "Split up in pairs. Shout. Look everywhere, but don't go inside. Not for any reason. And stay out of shadows. You can die here before you know it. You can all die before any of you know it. If you see her in a building, even if she looks just fine, find me unless she comes out to you." "We can search faster if we each search alone," Urien said, and Sulin nodded agreement. There were far too many nods.
"Pairs!"
Rand fought the fury down again. The light burn Aiel stubbornness. "At least that way you have somebody to watch your back. For once, do what I say when I say it. I've been here. I know a little about this place." A few minutes later, most spent in argument over how many should stay with Rand, 20 pairs of Aiel scattered. The one remaining was Jelani, Rand thought, though it was hard to tell with the veil. For once, she did not appear to be happy guarding him. The green eyes held a decided touch of sullenness.
"I suppose we could make another pair,"
Hammond said, looking at Kovril. She nodded.
"And Aerith can remain here."
"No," Rand and Aerith said almost at the same instant. The older Ogier turned with faces of grave disapproval. Aerith's ears sagged until they looked ready to fall off. Rand grabbed hold of his temper firmly. Once it had seemed that in the void, any anger was off in the far distance somewhere, attached to him by no more than a thread. More and more it threatened to overwhelm him, to overwhelm the void, which might be disastrous. Aside from that, though,
"I'm sorry. I had no business shouting at you, Elder Hammond, or you, Speaker Kovril."
Was that the right way to say it? Was it even a title of that sort? Nothing in their expressions said either way.
"I would appreciate it if you would all stay with me. Then we can all search together."
"Of course," Hammond said. "I really don't see how I can offer you more protection than you can offer yourself. But it is yours."
Kovril and Aerith both nodded approvingly. Rand had no idea what Hammond was talking about, but it did not seem the time to ask, with the three of them apparently bucked up to protect him. He had no doubt he could safeguard all three as long as they kept close.
"So long as you follow your own rules, Randall Thor,
The green-eyed maiden was indeed Jelani, and sounding heartened that she would not have to stand and wait. Rand hoped he had given the others a better idea of what this place was like. From the beginning, the search was frustrating. They walked up and down the streets, watched by invisible eyes, sometimes climbing over strewn rubble, taking turns calling, "Liar, liar." Covril's shouts made leaning walls creak. Hammond's made them groan ominously. Nothing answered. The only other sounds were the shouts of the search parties and mocking echoes along the streets. Liar, liar. The sun had climbed nearly overhead when Jelani said,
"I do not think she would have gone this far, Randall Thor, not unless she was trying to get away from us, and she would not do that."
Rand turned from peering through shadowed columns at the head of the wide stone steps, trying to see into a great chamber beyond. As far as he could make out, there was nothing in there but dust. No footprints. The unseen watchers had faded. They were not gone even now, but almost.
"We have to search as much as we can. Maybe she..."
He did not know how to finish.
"I won't leave her here, Jelani."
The sun swung higher and began to descend, and he was standing atop what had been a palace once, or maybe a whole block of buildings. It was a hill now, weathered enough over the years that only the number of broken bricks and pieces of worked stone sticking out of the dry soil said it had been anything else.
"Liar!"
he shouted through cupped hands.
"Liar!"
"Randall Thor,"
a maiden called from the street below, lowering her veil so he could see it was Sulin. She and another maiden, still veiled, stood with Jelani and the Ogier.
"Come down."
He scrambled down in a cloud of dust and a shower of bits of brick and stone, moving so fast that he nearly fell twice.
"You found her?"
Sulin shook her head.
"We should have by now if she is alive. She would have not gone far on her own. If anyone carried her far, they carried her dead, I think. She would not go easily. And if she was injured too badly to answer our shouts, I think that also must mean she is dead."
Hammond sighed sadly. The Ogier women's long eyebrows dropped to their cheekbones. For some reason, their sad, pitying looks were directed at Rand.
"Keep looking," he said. "May we look inside the buildings? There are many rooms we cannot see from outside."
Rand hesitated. Well short of mid-afternoon yet, and he could feel the eyes again. As strong as they had been with the sun setting his first time here. Shadows were not safe in Shadar Logoth.
"No, but we keep looking."
He was not sure how long he went on shouting his way up one street and down the next, but after a time Urien and Sulin stepped in front of him, both unveiled. The sun sat at the treetops to the west, a blood-red ball in a cloudless sky. Shadows stretched long across the ruins.
"I will search as long as you wish," Urien said, "but calling and looking have done what they can. If we could search the buildings..."
"No!"
It came out a croak, and Rand cleared his throat. Light, but he wanted a drink of water. The invisible watchers filled every window, every opening. Thousands of them, waiting, anticipating. And shadows cloaked the city. Shadows were not safe in Shadar Logoth, but darkness brought out death. Mashadar rose with sunset.
"Sulin, I..."
He could not make himself say they had to give up, leave Lya behind, whether she was dead or alive, maybe lying somewhere unconscious, behind a wall or under a heap of bricks that might have tumbled down on her. She could be.
"Whatever watches us is waiting for nightfall, I think," Sulin said. "I have looked into windows where something was looking back at me, but there was nothing there. Dancing the spears with something we cannot see will not be easy."
Rand realized he wanted her to say again that Lya must be dead, that they could go. Lya could be injured somewhere. It was possible. He touched his coat pocket. The fat little man Angrial was back in Camelin with his sword and the scepter. He was not sure he could protect everyone once night fell. Moraine had thought the whole White Tower could not kill Mashadar, if it could be said to be alive. Hammond cleared his throat.
"From what I remember of Arid Hall," he said, frowning, "of Shaddar Logoth, that is, when the sun goes down, we will probably all die."
"Yes," Rand breathed the word reluctantly. "Laia may be alive. All the others?" Kovril and Aerith had their heads together a little way off. He caught a murmur of loyal.
"Duty is heavier than a mountain, death lighter than a feather."
Luce Theron had to have that from him. Memories passed both ways across that barrier, it seemed, but it cut to the heart.
"We have to go now," he told them. "Whether Lai is alive or dead, we must go."
Urien and Sulin only nodded, but Aerith moved closer and patted him on the shoulder with surprising gentleness for a hand that could have gripped his head.
"If I might trouble you," Hammond said, "we have been rather longer than we expected."
He gestured to the sinking sun.
"If you would do us the favor of carrying us outside the city in the same way you brought us here, I would appreciate it greatly."
Rand remembered the forest outside Shaddar Logoth. No Murdrol or Trollocs there this time, but a thick wood, and the light alone knew how far to the nearest village or in what direction. "I will do better than that," he said. "I can take you straight to the two rivers as quickly." The two older Ogier nodded gravely.
"The blessing of the light and stillness be on you for your help," Kovril murmured.
Aerith's ears quivered with anticipation, perhaps equally for seeing Loyal and leaving Shaddar Logoth. Rand hesitated a moment. Loyal would probably be in Emmon's field, but he could not take them there. Too much chance news of his visit would slip out of the two rivers. Away from the village, then, far enough to avoid the farms that clustered close nearby. The vertical slash of light appeared and widened. The taint pounded inside him again, worse than before. The ground seemed to beat at the soles of his boots. Half a dozen Aiel leaped through, and the three Ogier followed with a haste that was not at all unseemly in the circumstances. Rand paused, looking back over the ruined city. He had promised to let the maidens die for him. As the last of the Aiel went through, Sulin hissed, and he glanced at her, but she was looking at his hand, at the back of his hand, where his fingernails had sliced a gash that oozed blood. Wrapped in the void as he was, the pain might have belonged to someone else. The physical mark did not matter. It would heal. He had made deeper inside, where no one could see. One for each maiden who died. And he never let them heal. "We are done here," he said, and stepped through the gateway into the two rivers. The throbbing vanished with the gateway. Frowning, Rand tried to orient himself. Placing a gateway precisely was not easy where you had never been before, but he had picked a field he did know, a weedy meadow a good two-hour walk south of Emmon's field that no one ever used for anything. In the lurid twilight, he could see sheep, though, a sizable flock, and a boy with a crook in his hands, and a bow on his back, staring at them from 100 paces. Rand did not need the power in him to tell the boy was goggling, as well he might. Dropping the crook, he set off running for a farmhouse that had not been there when Rand was last here. A tile-roofed farmhouse. For a moment, Rand wondered whether he was really in the two rivers at all. No, the feel of the place told him he was. The smell of the air shouted home. All those changes Bode and the rest of the girls had told him about, they had not really sunk in. Nothing ever really changed in the two rivers. Should he send the girls back here, back home?
"What you should do is stay clear of them."
It was an irritable thought. "Emmon's field is that way," he said. Emmon's field. Perrin. Tem might be there, too, at the Wine Spring Inn with Egwene's parents. That is where Loyal should be. I don't know if you can make it before dark. You might ask at the farmhouse. I'm sure they will give you a place to sleep. Don't tell them about me. Tell no one how you came." The boy had seen, but a boy's tale might be taken for exaggeration when Ogier appeared. Adjusting the bundles on their backs, Hammond and Kavril exchanged looks, and she said,
"We will say nothing of how we came. Let people make the stories they wish."
Hammond stroked his beard and cleared his throat.
"You must not kill yourself."
Even in the void, Rand was startled.
"What?"
"The road ahead of you," Hammond rumbled, "is long, dark, and I very much fear bloodstained. I also very much fear that you will take us all down that road. But you must live to reach the end of it."
"I will," Rand replied curtly. "Fare you well."
He tried to put some warmth into that, some feeling, but he was not sure he succeeded.
"Fare you well,"
Hammond said, and the women echoed it before all three turned toward the farmhouse. Not even Aerith sounded as if she believed he would, though. A moment longer, Rand stood there. People had appeared outside the house, watching the Ogier approach. But Rand stared north and west, not toward Emmon's field, but toward the farm where he had grown up. When he turned away and opened a gateway to Camelin, it was like tearing his own arm off. The pain was a much more suitable memorial for Lyra than a scratch. Chapter 22. Heading South. The five stones made a smoothly spinning circle above Matt's hands, one red, one blue, one clear green, the others striped in interesting ways. He rode on, guiding Pips with his knees, the black-hafted spear thrust between the saddle girth on the opposite side from his unstrung bow. The stones made him think of Tom Marilyn, who had taught him to juggle, and he wondered whether the old fellow was still alive. "Probably not." Rand had sent the Gleeman herring after Elaine and Nynaeve what seemed a very long time ago now, supposedly to look out for them. If any two women needed looking out for less, Matt did not know them. But no two were more likely to get a man killed because they would not listen to reason. Nynaeve, poking into everything a man did or said or thought and tugging her bloody braid at a fellow all the time, and Elaine, the bloody daughter heir, thinking she could get her way by sticking her nose in the air and telling you what for as bad as Nynaeve ever did. Only Elaine was worse, because if frosty high-handedness failed, Elaine smiled and flashed her dimple and expected everybody to fall down because she was pretty. He hoped Tom had managed to survive their company. He hoped they were all right, too, but he would not mind if they had found themselves in the pickling kettle at least once since scurrying off to the light new where. Let them see what it was like without him to haul them out, and never an honest word of thanks when he was there to do it. Not too hot a kettle, mind, just enough to make them wish Matt Cawthon were around to rescue them again like an idiot. "What about you, Matt?" Nalician asked, reining closer. "Did you ever think what it would be like to be a warder?" Matt nearly dropped the stones. Derrid and Talmanis looked at him, sweaty-faced and waiting an answer. The sun was sliding toward the horizon, not long before they would have to stop. Twilight seemed to last a little longer as the days shortened, but Matt wanted to be settled in with his pipe by dusk. Besides, in terrain like this, horses broke legs once the light failed. So did men. The band stretched out northward behind them, horse and foot beneath a rising tail of dust, banners flying but drums silent, across low hills covered with sparse scrub and scattered thickets. 11 days since leaving Meyrone, and they were halfway to Tyr, or a little better, moving faster than Matt had really hoped for. And only one full day spent resting the horses. He was certainly in no hurry to take Wireman's place, but he could not help wondering how much distance they could cover between sunup and sundown if they had to. So far, their best had been 45 miles, as near as anyone could calculate. Of course, the supply wagons took half the night catching up, but the foot had been making a point lately of showing they could match the horse over the long haul, if not the short. A little farther back and to the east, a band of Aiel crested a tree-fringed rise, running easily and slowly closing the distance. Likely they had been trotting since sunrise, and would until nightfall, if not later. If they passed the band, while there was still light to see, it would be encouragement for tomorrow. Whenever Aiel passed them, they seemed ready to try for another mile or two the next day. A few miles ahead, the thickets blended into solid forest again. It would be necessary to drop closer to the Aranin before they reached that. As they crested a hilltop, Matt could see the river, and the five hired riverboats flying the Red Hand. Four more were on their way back to Mehrun to reload, mainly with fodder for the horses. What he could not see, yet knew were there, were the people, some meandering upriver, some down, some changing direction, whenever they met a group led by someone with a convincing tongue. A handful had carts, usually pulled by themselves, and a few wagons, but most nothing beyond what they wore on their backs. Even the densest brigands had learned there was no point to bothering those. Matt had no idea where they were going, and neither did they, yet they were just enough to clog the sorry excuse for a road along the river. Short of clubbing people out of the way, the band could make much better time up here. "A warder?" Matt said, tucking the stones into his saddlebags. He could find more anywhere, but he liked the colors. He had an eagle feather in there, too, and a piece of weathered snow-white stone that might have been carved with scrolls once. There had been a boulder that looked as if it had been the head of a statue, too, but the thing would have needed a wagon. "Never! They're all fools and dupes, letting Aes Sedai lead them around by the nose. What put a notion like that in your head?" Nalesian shrugged. He fairly oozed sweat, but he still wore his coat, red-striped with blue today, buttoned to the neck. Matt's hung open, and he still thought he was broiling. "I suppose it's all the Aes Sedai," the Tyran said. "Burn my soul, it can't but make you think, can it? I mean, burn my soul, what are they up to?" He meant the Aes Sedai on the other side of the Aranin, reportedly scurrying upriver or down a sight quicker than the wanderers that were over there as well. "Best not to think about them is what I say," Matt touched the silver fox head through his shirt. Even with that, he was glad the Aes Sedai were across the river. A handful of his soldiers traveled on each of the river craft, and few as villages were, they put a boat ashore on his orders at every one they passed on the far side to see what they could learn. So far, the news had been unrevealing and often unpleasant. Aes Sedai swarming was the least of it. "And how are we not to think of them?" Tomanis asked. "Do you think the tower really did pull Loghain's strings?" That was one of the newer bits, just 2 days old. Matt pulled off his hat long enough to mop his forehead before answering. Nightfall would be a little cooler. But no wine, no ale, no women, and no gambling. Who would be a soldier for choice? "There's not much I'd say was beyond, Aes Sedai." Sliding a finger behind the scarf around his neck, he eased it. One thing about warders, by what he knew from observing Lan anyway, they never seemed to sweat. "But that? Talmanis, I believe you were Aes Sedai first." "You aren't, are you?" Dered doubled over the pommel of his saddle laughing, and Nalesian nearly fell off his horse. Talmanis stiffened at first, but finally he grinned. He almost chuckled. The man did not have much sense of humor, but he did have some. His seriousness reasserted itself quickly, though. "What about the dragon sworn? If it is true, Matt, it means trouble." The other's laughter might as well have been chopped with an axe. Matt grimaced. That was the newest news, or rumor, call it what you would, picked up yesterday. A village burned somewhere in Murindi. Worse, supposedly they had killed everybody who would not swear to the dragon reborn, and their families with them. "Rand will settle for them, if it's true. Aes Sedai, dragon sworn, all that is his business, and we're well out of it. We have our own to tend." That made nobody's face less grim, of course. They had seen too many burned villages, and thought they would see more soon after reaching Tyr. Who would be a soldier? A horseman appeared over the next rise ahead, galloping toward them, leaping his mount over brush rather than swerve around even on the downslope. Matt signed for a halt, adding, "No trumpets!" Word rippled behind him in a fading murmur, but he kept his eyes on the rider. Dripping sweat, Chell Vannon reined his dun gelding in before Matt. In a rough gray coat that fit his balding bulk like a sack, he sat his saddle like a sack, too. Vannon was fat, and no getting around it. Yet improbable as it seemed, he could ride anything ever born, and he was very good at what he did. Long before they reached Meyrone, Matt had surprised Nalisi and Darrett and Telmanus by asking for the names of the best poachers and horse thieves among their men, the ones they knew were guilty but could not prove anything against. The two nobles in particular had not wanted to admit having any such men in their commands, but after a little prodding they came up with the names of 3 Kyrianen, 2 Tyrans, and surprisingly 2 Andorans. Matt had not thought any of the Andorans had been with the band long enough to make themselves known like that, but apparently word got about. Those 7 men he took aside and told that he needed scouts, and that a good scout used much the same skills as a poacher or horse thief. Ignoring fervent denials that they had ever committed any crime whatsoever, more from each than from Telmanus and Nalisian combined, and just as eloquent, if far coarser, he offered pardons for any thefts done before that day, triple pay, and no work details as long as they reported the truth. And a hanging for the first lie. A lot of men could die from a scout's lie. Even with the threat, they leaped at it, probably more for less work than for the extra silver. But 7 was not enough, so he asked them to suggest others, and to keep in mind what he said about the needed skills, as well as the fact that whether they lived to collect their triple pay would depend in large part on the abilities of those they named. That caused a lot of chin-scratching and edgy looks, but between them they produced 11 more names, emphasizing all the while that they were not implying anything about those fellows. 11 men, good enough poachers and horse thieves that neither Darrod nor Telmanus nor Nalisian had suspected them, but not good enough to avoid the notice of the first 7. Matt made those the same offer and asked for names again. By the time he reached a point where no more names were to be found, he had 47 scouts. Hard times had put a lot of men to soldiering instead of the craft they would rather have followed. The last, named by all 3 just before him, had been Chell Vannon, an Andoran who lived in Meyrone but ranged wide on both sides of the Erinnin. Vannon could steal a hen pheasant's eggs without disturbing her on the nest, though it was unlikely he would fail to put her in the sack, too. Vannon could steal a horse out from under a nobleman without the nobleman knowing it for 2 days. Or so his recommenders claimed in tones of awe. With a gap-toothed smile and a look of utter innocence on his round face, Vannon had protested he was a stableman and sometime farrier, when he could find work. But he would take the job for 4 times the band's normal pay. So far, he had been more than worth it. Sitting his dun in front of Matt on that hilltop, Vannon looked disturbed. He approved of Matt not wanting to be called my lord, since he did not much like bowing to anyone, but he managed to knuckle his forehead casually in a rough sort of salute.
"I think you got to see this. I don't know what to make of it myself. You got to look for yourself."
"Wait here," Matt told the others, and to Vannon, "show me." It was not a long ride, just over the next 2 hills and up a winding stream with wide borders of dried mud. The smell announced what Vannon wanted him to see before the first vultures waddled into the air. The others just flapped a few paces before settling again, darting featherless heads and squawking challenges. Worst were those that never looked up from their dinners, milling piles of stained black feathers. An overturned wagon, like a little house on wheels, virulently painted in green and blue and yellow, identified the scene as a tinker caravan. But few of the wagons had escaped burning. Bodies lay everywhere in bright clothes, torn and darkened with dried blood, men and women and children. A part of Matt analyzed it coldly. The rest of him wanted to vomit or run. Anything but sit there on pips. The attackers had come from the west first. Most of the men and older boys lay there, mingled with what was left of a number of large dogs, as if they had tried to form a line to hold back killers with their bodies, while the women and children ran. A futile flight. Heaped corpses showed where they had run headlong into the second attack. Only the vultures moved now. Vannin spat disgustedly through a gap in his teeth.
You chase them off before they steal too much. They'll snap up children if you don't look sharp. Raise them as their own. Maybe you add a kick to speed them, but you don't do this. Who would?
I don't know. Brigands?
The horses were all gone, but brigands wanted to steal, not kill, and no tinker would resist if you stole his last penny and his coat to boot. Matt forced his hands to ease their grip on his reins. There was nowhere to look without seeing a dead woman, a dead child. Whoever did this had not wanted any survivors. He rode a slow circuit around the site, trying to ignore the vultures that hissed and flared their wings when he passed. The ground was too dry to hold tracks well, although he thought horses had gone in several directions, and came back to Vannin.
You could have told me about it. I don't need to see.
Light, but I don't.
I could have told you there was no good tracks, Vannin said, turning his horse to wade the shallow stream. Maybe you need to see this.
Fire had taken most of the wagon lying on its side, but the wagon bed survived, propped on yellow wheels with red spokes. A man in a coat that still showed a little eye-wrenching blue lay hard against it, one sprawled hand black with blood. What he had written in shaky letters stood out darker than the wood of the wagon bottom.
Tell the dragon reborn. Tell him what?
Matt thought. That somebody had killed a whole caravan of tinkers? Or had the man died before he could write whatever it was? It would not have been the first time tinkers had come on to important information. In a story, he would have lived just long enough to scrawl the vital bit that meant victory. Well, whatever the message, nobody was ever going to know a word more now.
You are right, Vannin.
Matt hesitated. Tell the dragon reborn what? No reason to start any more rumors than they already had. See the rest of this wagon burns before you leave. And if anybody asks, there was nothing here but a lot of dead men.
And women and children.
Vannin nodded.
Filthy savages,
he muttered, and spat through his teeth again.
Could have been some of them, I suppose.
That band of Aielmen had caught up, 300 or 400 strong. They trotted down the slope and crossed the stream no more than 50 paces from the wagons. A number raised a hand in greeting. Matt did not recognize them, but a good many Aiel had heard of Randall Thor's friend, he who wore the hat, and whom it was better not to gamble against. Across the stream and up the next slope, and all those bodies might as well not have existed.
Bloody Aiel,
Matt thought. He knew that Aiel avoided tinkers, ignored them, if not why, but this?
I don't think so, he said. See, it burns, Vannin.
Talmanis and the other two were right where he had left them, of course. When Matt told them what lay ahead and that burial parties had to be told off, they nodded grimly, Darad muttering a disbelieving,
Tinkers?
We will camp here, Matt added. He expected some comment. There was light left for a few more miles, and these three had gotten caught up in how far the band could move in a day to the point of laying wagers. But Nalesian just said, I'll send a man down to signal the ships before they get too far ahead. Maybe they felt the way he did. Unless they swung all the way over to the river, there would be no avoiding at least the sight of vultures scattering into the sky from the burial parties. Just because a man had seen death did not mean he had to enjoy it. For Matt's part, he thought another look at those birds would empty his stomach. In the morning, there would be only graves, safely out of earshot. The memory would not go out of his head, though, even after his tent was raised on that very hilltop, where it might catch a breeze off the river, if one ever decided to rise. Bodies hacked by killers, ravaged by vultures. Worse than the battle around Kyrian against the Shido. Maidens had died there, but he had not seen any, and there had been no children. A tinker would not fight even to defend his life. Nobody killed the traveling people. He picked at his beef and beans and retired to his tent as soon as he could. Even Elysian did not want to talk, and Talmanis looked tighter than ever. Word of the killing had spread. There was a quiet over the camp Matt had heard before. Usually the darkness would be broken by at least a little raucous laughter and sometimes songs, off-key and off-color, until the bannermen drove the handful who would not admit they were tired to their blankets. Tonight was like the times they had found a village with the dead unburied, or a group of refugees who had tried to keep their little from bandits. Few could laugh or sing after that, and those who could were usually silenced by the rest. Matt lay smoking his pipe while darkness fell, but the tent was close and sleep would not come for memories of Tinker dead, older memories of older dead. Too many battles and too many dead. He fingered his spear, traced the inscription in the old tongue along the black shaft. Thus is our treaty written, thus is agreement made. Thought is the arrow of time, memory never fades. What was asked is given, the price is paid. He had gotten the worst of that deal. After a time he gathered a blanket, and after a moment the spear, and padded outside in his small clothes, the silver fox head on his bare chest catching the light of the clipped moon. There was a slight breeze, a meager stirring with little coolness that scarcely shifted the red hand banner on its staff, stuck in the ground before his tent. Yet better than inside. Tossing his blanket down among the scrub, he lay on his back. When he was a boy, he'd sometimes used to put himself to sleep naming the constellations. In that cloudless sky, the moon gave enough light to wash out most stars, even if it was waning. But it left enough. There was the Haywain, high overhead, and the five sisters, and the three geese, pointing the way north. The archer, the plowman, the blacksmith, the snake. Ayu called that one the dragon. The shield, that some called Hawkwing's shield, that made him shift. In some of his memories, he did not like Artapan Drag Tanriel at all. The stag and the ram. The cup and the traveler with her staff standing out sharp. Something caught his ear. He was not sure what. If the night had not been so still, the faint sound might have seemed furtive. But it was, and it did. Who would be sneaking around up here? Curious, he lifted up on an elbow and froze. Like moon shadows, shapes moved around his tent. Moonlight caught one enough for him to make out a veiled face. Aiel? What, under the light? Silently they surrounded the tent, closed in. Bright metal flashed in the night, whispers of cloth being sliced, and they vanished inside. A moment only, and they were back out. And looking around, there was light enough to see that. Matt gathered his feet under him. If he kept low, he might be able to slip away without being heard. Matt! Talmanis called up the hillside. He sounded drunk. Matt went still. Maybe the man would go back if he thought he was asleep. The Aiel seemed to melt away, but he was sure they had gone to ground where they were. Talmanis' boots crunched closer.
"I have some brandy here, Matt. I think you should take it. It is very good for dreams, Matt. You do not remember them."
Matt wondered whether the Aiel would hear him over Talmanis if he went now. 10 paces or so to where the nearest men would be sleeping. The first banner of Horus, Talmanis' thunderbolts, had the honor tonight. Less than 10 to his tent and the Aiel. They were fast, but with a step or two, they should not catch him before he had 50 men almost within arm's reach.
"Matt, I do not believe you are asleep, Matt. I saw your face. It is better once you kill the dreams. Believe me, I know."
Matt crouched, clutching his spear and taking a deep breath. 2 strides.
"Matt!"
Talmanis was nearer. The idiot was going to step on an Aiel any time now.
They would cut his throat without making a sound.
Burn you, Matt thought. All I needed was two strides.
Out swords! He shouted, leaping upright. Aiel in camp!
He sprinted down the slope.
Rally to the banner! Rally to the Red Hand! Rally, you dog-riding grave robbers!
That woke everyone, of course, as well it should, with him bellowing like a bull in briars. Shouts spread in every direction. Drums began beating assembly, trumpets sounding rally. Men of the first horse roared out of their blankets, racing toward the banner, waving swords. Still, the fact was, the Aiel had a shorter distance to run than the soldiers, and they knew what they were after. Something, instinct, his luck, being Taviran, Matt certainly did not hear anything over the racket, made him turn just as the first veiled shape appeared behind, as if springing out of the air. No time to think. He blocked the thrust of a stabbing spear with the haft of his spear, but the Aiel caught his return slash on a buckler and kicked him in the belly. Desperation gave Matt strength to keep his legs straight with no air in his lungs. He twisted aside frantically from his spearhead that sliced his ribs, clipped the Aiel's legs out from under him with his own spear haft, and stabbed him through the heart. Light, but he hoped it was a him. He jerked the spear free just in time to face the onslaught. I should have run when I first had the bloody chance. He worked the thing like a quarterstaff as fast as he ever had in his life, spinning, blocking away lancing Aiel spear points, no time to strike back. Too many. I should have kept my bloody mouth shut and run. He found breath again.
Rally, you pigeon-gutted sheep-stealers! Are you all deaf? Clean out your ears and rally!
Wondering why he was not dead yet, he had been lucky with one Aiel, but nobody had enough luck to face this, he suddenly realized he was no longer alone. A skinny Kyrianin in his small clothes fell nearly under his feet with a shrill yell, only to be replaced by a Tyran with his shirt flapping and sword swinging. More crowded in, shouting everything from Lord Matrimon Victory to the Red Hand to Kill the Black-Eyed Vermin. Matt slipped back and left them to it. The general who leads in the front of a battle is a fool. That came from one of those old memories, a quote from somebody whose name was not part of the memory. A man could get killed in there. That was pure Matt Cawthon. In the end, it was a sheer matter of numbers. A dozen Aiel, and, if not the whole band, several hundred who managed to reach the hilltop before it was done. 12 Aiel dead, and because they were Aiel, half again as many of the band, with twice that or more bleeding if still alive to groan, while they were tended. Even with his brief exposure, Matt stung and bled at half a dozen places, at least three of which he suspected would need stitching. His spear made a good walking staff as he limped around to where Talmanis was stretched out on the ground with Darid tying a tourniquet around his left leg. Talmanis's white shirt, hanging loose, glistened darkly in two places.
"It seems," he panted, "Nerim will get to try his hand as a seamstress on me again. Burn him for a ham-fisted bull."
Nerim was his serving man and mended his master as often as his master's clothes.
"Will he be all right?" Matt asked softly.
Darid shrugged. He wore only his breeches.
"He is bleeding less than you, I think."
He glanced up. He would have a new scar to add to the collection on his face.
"As well you got out of their way, Matt. It is clear they were after you." "Good not to give them what they came for."
Wincing, Talmanis struggled to his feet with the aid of an arm over Darid's shoulder.
"It would be a shame to lose the band's luck to a handful of savages in the night."
Matt cleared his throat.
"That's the way it seemed to me, too."
The image of the Aiel vanishing into his tent welled up in his mind, and he shivered. Why under the light would Aiel want to kill him? Nalesian appeared from where the dead Aiel were laid out in a row. Even now he had his coat on, though not buttoned. He kept frowning at a bloodstain on the lapel. Maybe his blood, maybe not.
"Burn my soul, I knew those savages would turn on us sooner or later. I expect they came from that lot who passed us earlier."
"I doubt it," Matt said.
"If they had wanted me, they could have had me spitted and over the fire for dinner before any of you knew it."
Matt made himself hobble over and studied the Aiel, taking a lantern someone had brought to aid the moonlight. The relief of finding only men's faces nearly unhinged his knees. He did not know any of them, but then he did not really know many Aiel. "Shido, I expect," he said, returning to the others with the lantern. They could be Shido. They could be Dark Friends. He knew all too well that there were Dark Friends among the Aiel. And Dark Friends, of course, did have reason to want him dead.
"Tomorrow," Darad said, "I think we should try to find one of those Aes Sedai across the river. Talmanis here will live, unless all the brandy leaked out of him, but some of the others might not be so fortunate."
Nalesian said nothing, but his grunt spoke volumes. He was Tyran, after all, with less love than Matt for Aes Sedai. Matt did not hesitate in agreeing. He would not be letting any Aes Sedai channel at him. In a way, every scar marked a small victory. Another time he had avoided Aes Sedai. But he could not ask a man to die. Then he told them what else he wanted.
"A ditch,"
Talmanis said in tones of disbelief.
"All the way around the camp?"
Nalesian's pointed beard quivered.
"Every night?" "And a palisade?"
Darad exclaimed. Glancing around, he lowered his voice. There were still quite a few soldiers about, hauling away the dead.
"There will be a mutiny, Matt."
"No, there won't," Matt said. "By morning, every last man will know Aiel sneak through the whole camp to reach my tent. Half won't sleep for thinking they will wake with an Aiel spear in their ribs. You three make sure they understand the fact that a palisade just might keep Aiel from sneaking in again. At the least, it would slow them down. Now go away and let me get a little sleep tonight." After they had gone, he studied his tent. Long slashes in the walls where Aiel had gone in stirred in the fitful breeze. Sighing, he started to return to his blanket in the scrub, then hesitated. That noise that had alerted him. The Aiel had not made another, not a whisper. A shadow made as much noise as an Aiel. So what had it been? Leaning on his spear, he limped around the tent, studying the ground. He was not sure what he was looking for. Soft Aiel boots had left no marks that he could make out by lantern light. Two of the tent ropes hung where they had been cut, but... He set the lantern down and fingered the ropes. That sound could have been taut rope being sliced, yet there was no reason to cut these to get inside. Something about the angle of the cuts, the way they lined up with one another, caught his attention. Taking up the lantern, he cast around. A wiry bush not far away had been trimmed along one side, thin branches with small leaves lying on the ground. A very neat trimming, perfectly flat, the severed branch ends smooth as though planed by a cabinet maker. The hair on the back of Matt's neck stirred. One of those holes in the air that Rand used had been opened here. Bad enough that Aiel had tried to kill him, but they had been sent by somebody who could make one of those... gateways, Rand called them. Light, if he was not safe from the Forsaken with the band around him, where was he safe? He wondered how he was going to sleep from now on with watchfires around his tent. And guards. A guard of honor, he could call it, to take some of the sting away, to stand sentry around his tent. Next time, it would probably be 100 Trollocs, or 1,000, instead of a handful of Aiel. Or was he important enough for that? If they decided he was too important, the next time it could be one of the Forsaken. Blood and ashes. He had never asked to be Taviren, never asked to be tied to the dragon bloody reborn. Blood and bloody... Soil crunching underfoot warned him, and he spun, swinging the spear with a snarl. Barely in time, he stopped the slashing blade as Alvar screamed and fell flat on his back, staring wide-eyed at the spear point.
"What in the bloody pit of doom are you doing here?" Matt snapped.
I...
The boy stopped to swallow.
"They say 50 Aiel tried to kill you in your sleep, Lord Matt. But you killed them first, and I wanted to see if you were all right, and... Lord Adorian bought me some shoes, see?"
He raised a shod foot. Muttering under his breath, Matt hauled Alvar to his feet.
"That wasn't what I meant. Why aren't you in Mehrone?
Didn't Adorian find somebody to look after you?
She just wanted Lord Adorian's coin, not me. She had 6 children of her own. Master Burden gives me lots to eat, and all I have to do is feed and water his horses and rub them down. I like that, Lord Matt. He will not let me ride them, though.
The throat cleared.
Lord Talmanis sent me, my lord.
Nerim was short, even for a Kyrianan. A skinny, gray-haired man with a long face that seemed to say nothing was going well at the moment, and in the long run, this was a better day than most.
If my lord will pardon me for saying, those bloodstains will never come out of my lord's small clothes, but if my lord will allow it, I may be able to do something for the tears in my lord.
He had his sewing box under one arm.
You, boy, fetch some water. No back talk. Water for my lord, and quickly.
Nerim combined, picking up the lantern with a bow.
If my lord will step inside, night air is bad for wounds.
In short order, Matt was stretched out beside his bedding.
My lord will not want to stain his blankets,
letting Nerim wash away dried blood and sew him up.
Talmanis was right. As a seamstress, the man was a ham-fisted cook.
With Alvar there was no choice but to grit his teeth and bear it. To try taking his mind elsewhere than Nerim's needle, Matt pointed to the frayed cloth strip hanging from Alvar's shoulder.
"What do you have in there?"
he panted. Alvar clutched the tattered bag to his chest. He was certainly cleaner than he had been, if no prettier. The shoes appeared stout, and his woolen shirt and breeches looked new.
"It is mine," he said defensively. "I did not steal anything."
After a moment, he opened the bag and began laying things out. A spare pair of breeches, 2 more shirts, and some stockings had no interest for him, but he listed the other things.
"This is my red hawk's feather, Lord Matt, and this stone is just the color of the sun, see?"
He added a small purse.
"I have 5 coppers and a silver penny."
A rolled cloth tied with a string and a small wooden box.
"My game of snakes and foxes. My father made it for me. He drew the board."
For a moment his face crumpled, then he went on.
"And see, this stone has a fish head in it. I do not know how it got there. And this is my turtle shell. A blue-black turtle. See the stripes?"
Wincing at a particularly hard thrust of the sewing needle, Matt stretched his hand to finger the rolled cloth. Much better if he breathed through his nose. It was odd how those holes in his real memories worked. He could remember how to play snakes and foxes, but not ever playing it.
"That's a fine turtle shell, Alvar. I had one once. A green basker."
Stretching his hand the other way, he reached his own purse. He dipped out 2 gold Kyrianan crowns.
"Add these to your purse, Alvar. A man needs a little gold in his pocket."
Stiffly, Alvar began stuffing things back into his scrip.
"I do not beg, Lord Matt. I can work for my supper. I am not a beggar."
"Never meant to say you are." Matt cast around hurriedly for some reason to pay the boy 2 crowns.
I need someone to carry messages for me. Can't ask any of the band. They are all busy soldiering. Of course, you'd have to take care of your own horse. I could not ask anybody to do it for you."
Alvar sat up straight.
"I would have my own horse?"
he said incredulously.
"Of course. There is one thing. My name is Matt. You call me Lord Matt again, and I'll tie your nose in a knot."
Bellowing, he jerked half upright.
"Burn you, Nerim, that's a leg, not a bloody side of beef." "As my lord says," Nerim murmured, "my lord's leg is not a side of beef. Thank you, my lord, for instructing me."
Alvar was feeling his nose hesitantly, as if considering whether it could be tied in a knot. Matt settled back with a groan. Now he had saddled himself with a boy, and had done the lad no favor. Not if he was nearby the next time the Forsaken tried to reduce the number of Tavirn in the world. Well, if Rand's plan worked, there would be one less Forsaken. If Matt Cawthon had his way, he intended to stay out of trouble and out of danger until there were no Forsaken.
Chapter 23 To Understand a Message. Grendel managed not to stare as she entered the room, but her strithe gown went dead black before she could control herself and return it to a blue mist. Samael had done enough to make anyone doubt that this chamber was in the Grand Hall of the Council in Ilion, but then she would be very surprised if anyone but he ever penetrated this far uninvited into Lord Bren's apartments. The air was pleasantly cool. In one corner rose the hollow cylinder of an exchanger. Glow bulbs, bright and steady, stood oddly in heavy gold candle holders, giving much better illumination than candles or oil lamps ever could. A small music box sat on the marble mantelpiece, producing from its memory the soft strains of a sound sculpture that very likely had not been heard outside this room in well over 3,000 years, and she recognized several of the artworks on the walls. She paused in front of Saren Toll's Tempo of Infinity, not a copy. "One might think you had looted a museum, Samael." It was hard to keep the envy from her voice, and when she saw his faint smile, she realized she'd failed. Filling two silver-chased goblets with wine, he handed her one. Only a stasis box. I suppose people tried to save what they could in the last days. His smile pulled at that awful scar across his face as he beamed around the chamber with a special fondness for the Zara board projecting its field of still-transparent boxes in the air. He had always liked the more violent games. Of course, a Zara board meant his stasis box had been filled by someone who followed the Great Lord. Possession of a single once-human playing piece had meant imprisonment at the least on the other side. What else had he found? Sipping her wine, and suppressing a sigh, it was from the here and now. She had hoped for a delicate satare, or one of the exquisite komalads. She stroked her gown with beringed fingers. I found one as well, but beyond strife, it contained the most appalling collection of useless rubbish. After all, since he had invited her here and let her see this, it was a time for confidences. Small confidences. How sad for you. Again that faint smile. He had found something more than playthings and pretties. On the other hand, he went on, think how awful it would have been to open a box and rouse a nest of Kaffar, say, or a Jumara, or one of Aginor's other little creations. Did you know there are Jumara loose in the Blight? Full grown, though they'll never transform now. They call them worms. He laughed so hard at that he shook. Grendel smiled a good deal more warmly than she felt inside, though if her gown changed color, it was by a hair. She had had an unpleasant, in fact almost fatal experience with one of Aginor's creations. The man had been brilliant in his way, but mad. None but a madman would have made the golem. You seem in very good mood.
Why should I not be? He said expansively. I all but have my hands on a cache of Angreal, and who can say what else? Do not look so surprised. Of course I've known that the rest of you have been trying to look over my shoulder in hopes I will lead you to it. Well, it will do you no good. Oh, I will share, but after it's mine, and after I have first choice.
Sprawling in a heavily gilded chair, or perhaps it was solid gold, that would be like him— He balanced one boot atop the toe of the other and stroked his golden beard. Besides, I sent an emissary to Althor, and the answer was favorable. Grendel almost spilled her wine. It was? I heard that he killed your messenger. If her knowing that much shook him, he held it in. He even smiled.
Althor killed no one. Andris went there to die. Do you think I wanted to wait on couriers or pigeons? How he died told me Althor's answer.
Which was, she said carefully, a truce between us. Icy fingers seemed to dig into her scalp. It could not be true. Yet he looked more at ease than she had seen him since waking.
Lose Theron would never lose. Theron is long dead, Grendel.
The interruption was amused, even mocking. No anger at all. She covered a deep breath by pretending to drink.
Could it be true? His army is still gathering in Tyr. I have seen it. That hardly looks like a truce to me. Samael laughed outright. It takes time to redirect an army. Believe me, it will never move against me. You think not? One or two of my little friends say he wants you dead because you killed some of his pet maidens. Were I you, I would be thinking about somewhere less conspicuous, somewhere he might not find me. Not a flicker of an eyelid out of him. It was as if all the strings that usually moved him had been cut. What should it matter if few maidens died? The look on his face was truly puzzled. It was battle. Soldiers die in battle. Althor may be a farmer, but he has generals to fight his battles and explain matters. I doubt he even noticed. You really never have looked at these people. They have changed as much as the land, Samael. Not just the Aiel. In some ways the rest have changed much more. Those soldiers were women, and to Randall Thor that makes a difference. He shrugged dismissively, and she suppressed contempt, kept the strife steady in a calm fog. He had never understood that you must understand people to make them do as you wished. Compulsion was all very well, but you could not use compulsion on the entire world. She wondered whether the stasis box had been this cache that he claimed he would put his hands on soon. If he had even one Angreal. If he did, she would find out, but probably not before he'd let her. I suppose we shall see how much wiser the primitive Luz Theron has become, then. She raised a doubting eyebrow, managed a smile of her own. No reaction. Where had he found this leash for his temper? Luz Theron's name alone should have been enough to loose it. If he fails to chase you out of Ilion like a Kosa scampering up a tree, perhaps that might be waiting too long, he cut in smoothly. Too long for you, that is. Is that supposed to be a threat, Samael? Her gown shifted to a pale rose, but she let it stay. Let him be aware she was angry. I thought you learned long ago that threatening me is a mistake. No threats, Grendel, he replied calmly. All of his pressure points had gone numb. Nothing seemed to shift him out of that amused coolness. Merely facts. Althor will not attack me, and I will not attack him. And of course I agreed not to aid any other chosen should Althor find them. All very much in accordance with the Great Lord's commands, wouldn't you say? Of course. She kept her face smooth, but the strife had gone a deeper rose, losing some of its mistiness. In part, the color was still anger. There was more to this, but how was she to find out? Which means, he continued, that on the day of return I will very likely be the only one remaining to face Althor. I doubt he will manage to kill all of us, she said acidly, but acid churned in her stomach as well. Too many of the chosen had died. Samael had found a way to stand aside until the last. It was the only explanation. You think not? Not even if he learns where you all are? That smile deepened. I'm sure I know what Demondred is scheming, but where is he hiding? Where is Semirag? Messana? What about Asmodian and Lanfear? Mogedion? Those cold fingers returned, imprinting themselves on her skull. He would not lounge there and talk this way. He would not dare suggest what he was suggesting unless... Asmodian and Lanfear are dead, and I am sure Mogedion must be too. She was surprised to hear her own voice, hoarse and unsteady. Wine did not seem to dampen her dry throat. And the others? It was just a question. His voice was not in the slightest insistent. It sent a shiver through her. I've told you what I know, Samael, which is nothing. When I am nameless, I will choose who stands just below me. That one will have to be alive to receive the Great Lord's touch. Are you saying you have been to Sheol Ghul? That the Great Lord promised you? You will know all when it is time and not before. But a small advice, Grendel. Prepare now. Where are they? Her mind worked furiously. He must have had that promise. He must. But why him? No, there was no time for speculation. The Great Lord chose as he wished.
and Samael knew where she was, at least. She could flee Arad-Doman, establish herself elsewhere. It would not be difficult. Giving up the little games she played there, and even the larger games that might have to be abandoned, would be a small loss compared with having Al-Thor, or Luz Theron, come after her. She had no intention of ever confronting him directly. If Ishamael and Ravin had fallen to him, she was not about to risk his strength, not head-on. Samael must have had the promise. If he died now, he was certainly holding Saidin. He would be mad to say these things otherwise, and he would feel the instant she embraced Saidar. She would be the one to die. He must have had it. I do not know where Dimandred or Semirag is. Messana is in the White Tower. That is all I know. I swear it. A tightness in her chest loosened when he finally nodded. You will find the others for me. It was not a question. All of them, Grendal. If you want me to believe anyone dead, show me a corpse. She very much wished she dared turn him into a corpse. Her gown rippled through violent shades of red, echoing the anger and fear and shame that rippled through her uncontrollably. Very well. Let him think her cowed for the moment. If he fed Messana to Al-Thor, if he fed them all to Al-Thor, so be it, so long as that kept Al-Thor from her own throat. I will try. Do more than try, Grendel. More than try.
When Grendel was gone, the gateway back to her palace in Arad-Daman closed, Samael let the smile dissolve on his face. His jaws ached from holding it. Grendel thought too much. She was so used to making others act for her that she failed to think of acting for herself. He wondered what she would say if she ever discovered that he had manipulated her as deftly as she had manipulated so many fools in her time. He would wager everything that she never saw his real purpose. So Messana was inside the White Tower. Messana in the tower and Grendel in Arad-Daman. Had Grendel been able to see his face then, she would have known real fear. Whatever happened, Samael intended to be the one still standing on the day of return, to be named Nablus and defeat the dragon reborn.
Chapter 24. An Embassy. Turning away from the musicians on the street corner, a perspiring woman puffing at a long flute and a red-faced man plucking a 9-string bittern, Egwene threaded her way through the crowd with a light heart. The sun stood high in the sky, molten gold, and the paving stones were hot enough to burn through the soles of her soft boots. Sweat dripped from her nose. Her shawl felt like a heavy blanket even looped loosely over her elbows, and there was enough dust in the air that she already wanted to wash, yet she smiled. Some people eyed her askance when they thought she was not looking, which almost made her laugh. That was how they looked at Aiel. People saw what they expected to see, and they saw a woman in Aiel garb, never noticing her eyes or her height. Hawkers and peddlers cried their wares, competing against the shouts of butchers and candle-makers, the rattle and clatter from silversmiths and potters' shops, the squeal of ungreased axles. Rough-tongued wagon drivers and men walking alongside ox-carts loudly contested the way with dark-lacquered sedan chairs and sober coaches with house sigils on the doors. There were musicians everywhere, along with tumblers and jugglers. A knot of pale women in riding dresses carrying swords swaggered by, imitating how they imagined men behaved, laughing too raucously, and pushing their way in a manner that would have started a dozen fights in 100 paces had they been men. A blacksmith's hammer rang on his anvil. In general, a babble and hum of bustle hung in the air, the noise of a city that she'd almost forgotten among the Aiel. Perhaps she had missed it. She did laugh then, right there in the street. The first time she had heard the noise of a city, it had nearly stunned her. Sometimes it seemed that wide-eyed girl had been someone else. A woman working her bay mare through the crowd turned to look at her curiously. The horse had small silver bells tied in her long mane and tail, and the woman had more bells in the dark hair that hung halfway down her back. Pretty, she could not have been much older than Egwene, but she had a hardness to her face and a sharp eye, and no fewer than 6 knives at her belt, one nearly as large as an Aiel's. A hunter for the horn, no doubt. A tall, handsome man in a green coat, 2 swords on his back, watched the woman ride on. He was probably another. They seemed to be everywhere. As the crowd swallowed the woman on the bay, he turned and saw Egwene looking at him. Smiling with sudden interest, he squared broad shoulders and started toward her. Hastily, Egwene put on her coldest face, tried to combine Cerulea at her sternest with Swan Sanche, the stole of the Ammerlin seat around her shoulders. He stopped, looking surprised. As he turned away, she distinctly heard him growl, "Flaming Aiel!" She could not help laughing again. He must have heard, despite the noise, because he stiffened, shaking his head. But he did not look back. The source of her good mood was twofold. One was the wise ones finally agreeing that walking in the city provided as much exercise as walking around it outside the walls. Cerulea, in particular, did not seem to understand why she wanted to spend a minute more than she had to among throngs of wetlanders, especially cramped inside walls. Mostly, though, she felt good because they had told her that now the headaches that had puzzled them so were completely gone. She had not been able to hide them altogether. She could return to Tel Iranriod soon. Not in time for the next meeting, 3 nights off, but before the one after. That was a relief in more ways than one. An end to having to sneak into the world of dreams. An end to laboriously working everything out for herself. An end to being terrified the wise ones would catch her and refuse to teach her anymore. An end to needing to lie. It was necessary. She could not afford to waste time. There was too much to learn, and she could not believe she would have time to learn it all, but they would never understand. Aiel dotted the crowd, both in Karinsor and in Gaishine white. The Gaishine went where they were sent, yet the others might well be inside the walls for their first time, and quite possibly their last. The Aiel really did not seem to like cities, though a good many had come in 6 days ago to see Mangin hang. It was said he put the noose around his own neck, and made some Aiel joke about whether the rope would break his neck or his neck the rope. She had heard several Aiel repeat the joke, but never a comment about the hanging. Rand had liked Mangin, she was sure of it. Berylaine had informed the wise ones of the sentence as though telling them their wash would be ready the next day, and the wise ones had listened the same day. Egwene did not think she would ever understand Aiel. She was very much afraid she did not understand Rand anymore. As for Berylaine, Egwene understood her all too well. That one was only interested in men who were alive. With thoughts like those, it took an effort to regain her good mood. The city was certainly no cooler than outside the walls. In fact, with no breeze and people so close, it might have been hotter, and nearly as dusty, but at least she was not trudging along with nothing to look at but the ashes of Forgate. A few more days and she would be able to learn again, to really learn. That put a smile back on her face. She stopped near a wiry, damp-faced illuminator. It was easy to tell what he was, or had been. His thick mustaches were not covered by the diaphanous veil Taraboners often wore, but baggy breeches embroidered on the legs and an equally loose shirt embroidered across the chest marked him well enough. He was selling finches and warblers in crudely made cages. With their chapter house burned by the Shido, a number of illuminators were trying to find the means to return to Tarabon. "I have it from the most reliable source," he was telling a handsome, graying woman in a plainly cut dark blue dress. A merchant, no doubt, catching a jump on those waiting for better times in Kyrian. "The Aes Sedai," the illuminator confided, leaning over a caged bird to whisper. "They are divided. The Aes Sedai, they are at war with one another." The merchant nodded agreement. Egwene stopped pretending to consider a green-headed finch and moved on, though she had to hop out of the way of a round-faced gleeman, striding along with self-important flourishes of his patch-covered cloak. Gleemen knew very well that they were among the few wetlanders welcome in the waste. Aiel did not intimidate them. At least they pretended so. That rumor troubled her. Not that the tower had split apart. That could not have been kept secret much longer, but talk of war between Aes Sedai. Knowing that Aes Sedai were set against Aes Sedai was like knowing one part of her family was set against another, just barely tolerable for knowing the reasons, yet the thought that it might come to more. If only there were some way to heal the tower, to make it whole again without bloodshed. A little farther down the street, a perspiring foregate woman who might have been pretty if her face were cleaner was dispensing rumor along with ribbons and pins from a tray hung from a neck strap. She wore a blue silk dress, slashed with red in the skirt, that had been made for a shorter woman. The heavily worn hem was high enough to show her stout shoes, and holes in the sleeves and bodice showed where embroidery had been picked out. "I tell you a fact," she informed the women, picking over her tray. "There has been trollocs seen around the city. Ah, oh, yes, that green will set off your eyes. Hundreds of trollocs, and—" Egwene barely paused. If there had been even one trolloc anywhere near the city, the Aiel would have known long before it became street gossip. She wished the wise ones gossiped. Well, they did sometimes, but only about other Aiel. As far as Aiel were concerned, nothing about Wetlanders was very absorbing. Being able to pop into Elida's study and tell Irun Riod whenever she wanted and read the woman's letters had accustomed her to knowing what was happening in the world, though. Abruptly, Egwene realized she was looking around differently, looking at people's faces. There were Aes Sedai eyes and ears in Cairhien as surely as she was sweating. Elida must receive a report a day by pigeon from Cairhien, if not more. Tower spies, Aja spies, spies for individual Aes Sedai. They were everywhere, often where and who you least suspected. Why were those two tumblers just standing there? Were they catching their breath or watching her? They sprang back into action, one leaping up to a handstand on the other's shoulders. A spy for the Yellow Aja had once tried to bundle Elaine and Nynaeve off to Tar Valon on orders issued by Elida. Egwene did not actually know that Elida wanted her as well, but assuming anything else would be very foolish. Egwene could not make herself believe that Elida would forgive anyone who had worked closely for the woman she deposed. For that matter, some of the Aes Sedai in Salidar probably had eyes and ears here, too. If word ever reached them of Egwene Sedai of the Green Aja, it could be anybody. That skinny woman in the shop door apparently studying a bolt of dark gray cloth. Or the blousy woman lolling beside the tavern door, flapping her apron at her face. Or that fat fellow with his pushcart full of pies. Why was he looking at her so strangely? She very nearly headed for the nearest city gate. It was the fat fellow who stopped her, or rather the way he suddenly tried to cover his pies with his hands. He was staring at her because she had been staring at him. He was probably afraid an Aiel savage was going to take some of his wares without paying. Egwene laughed weakly. Aiel. Even people who looked her in the face assumed she was Aiel. A tower agent who was looking for her would walk right past. Feeling a good deal better, she went back to meandering through the streets, listening where she could. The trouble was she had grown used to knowing things just weeks or even days after they happened, and with a certainty that they had happened. Rumor might cross 100 miles in a day or take a month, and it birthed 10 daughters every day. Today she learned that Swan had been executed because she unearthed the Black Aja, that Swan was Black Aja and still alive, that the Black Aja had driven those Aes Sedai who were not black from the tower. They were not new tales, only variations on old. One new story spreading like fire in a summer meadow was that the tower had been behind all the false dragons. That made her so angry she stalked away stiff-backed every time she heard it. Which meant she did a good bit of stiff-backed stalking. She heard that Andorans in Arangil had declared some noblewoman queen, Dailin, Dailin, the name varied, now that Morgays was dead, which might be true. And that Aes Sedai were running around Arad Doman doing very improbable things, which was certainly untrue. The prophet was coming to Cairhien. The prophet had been crowned king of Gildan. No, Amadisia. The dragon reborn had killed the prophet for blasphemy. The Aiel were all leaving. No, they meant to settle and stay. Berelaine was to be crowned on the Sun Throne. A skinny little man with shifty eyes nearly got himself beaten by his listeners outside a tavern for saying that Rand was one of the Forsaken, but Egwene stepped into that without thought. "Have you no honor?" she demanded coldly. The four coarse-faced men who had been on the point of grabbing the skinny fellow blinked at her. They were Kyrianen, not all that much taller than she, but much bulkier, with the broken noses and sunken knuckles of brawlers, yet she held them where they stood with her sheer intensity. That and the presence of Aiel in the street, they were not fool enough to become rough with an Aiel woman, as they thought in those circumstances. "If you must face a man for what he says, face him one at a time in honor. This is not battle. You shame yourselves to go four at one." They stared at her as if she were mad, and slowly her face reddened. She hoped they thought it anger. Not how dare you pick on someone weaker, but how dare you not let him fight you one by one. She had just lectured them as if they followed Ji-Ito. Of course, if they did, there would have been no need to lecture. One of the men ducked his head in a sort of half-bow. His nose was not only crooked, the tip was missing.
He is gone now. Mistress, can we go, too?
It was true. The skinny man had used her interference to vanish. She felt a flash of contempt. Running because he feared to face four. How could he bear the shame? Light, she was doing it again! She opened her mouth to say that of course they could, and nothing came out. They took her silence for assent, or maybe excuse, and hurried away, but she barely noticed them go. She was too busy staring at the back of a mounted party making its way up the street. She did not recognize the dozen or so green-cloaked soldiers forcing a path through the crowd, but who they escorted was a different matter. She could only see the backs of the women, five or six, she thought, between the soldiers, just parts of their backs, but that was more than enough, much more. The women wore light dust cloaks, pale linen in shades of brown, and Egwene found herself staring right at what seemed to be a pure white disc embroidered on the back of one of those cloaks. Only the stitching picked out the white flame of Tar Valon from the border signifying the white Aja. She caught a glimpse of green, of red. Red. Five or six Aes Sedai riding toward the royal palace, where a copy of the dragon banner waved fitfully atop a stepped tower alongside one of Rand's crimson flags bearing the ancient Aes Sedai symbol. Some called that the dragon banner, and others Althor's banner, or even the Aiel banner, and a dozen other names besides. Wriggling through the crowd, she followed them maybe 20 paces, then stopped. A red sister, at least one red that she had seen, had to mean this was the long-expected embassy from the tower, the one Elida had written would escort Rand to Tar Valon. More than 2 months since that letter arrived by a hard-riding courier, this party must have left not long behind. They would not find Rand, not unless he had slipped in unannounced. She had decided that he had somehow rediscovered the talent called traveling, but that put her no closer to knowing how it was done. Yet, whether they found Rand or not, they must not find Egwene. The best she could expect was to be hauled up short as an accepted out of the tower with no full sister to oversee her, and that could be expected only if Elida really was not hunting for her. Even then they would haul her back to Tar Valon and Elida. She had no illusions that she could resist five or six Aes Sedai. With a last look after the receding Aes Sedai, she gathered her skirts and began to run, dodging between people, sometimes caroming off them, ducking under the noses of teams pulling wagons or carriages. Angered shouts followed her. When she at last dashed through one of the tall, square-arched city gates, the hot wind hit her in the face. Unhindered by buildings, it carried sheets of dust that made her cough, but she kept running, all the way back to the Wise One's low tents. To her surprise, a sleek gray mare, saddle and bridle worked and fringed with gold, stood outside Amis's tent, in the charge of a Gaishine who kept his eyes down, except when patting the spirited animal. Ducking inside, she found the rider, Berylaine, sipping tea with Amis and Bear and Cerilia, all stretched out on bright tasseled cushions. A white-robed woman, Rodera, knelt to one side, meekly waiting to refill cups. "There are Aes Sedai in the city," Egwene said as soon as she was inside, heading toward the Sun Palace. It must be Elida's embassy to Rand. Berylaine rose gracefully. Egwene had to admit, if grudgingly, that the woman was graceful. And her riding dress was decently cut, for even she was not fool enough to go riding in the sun in her usual garb. The others rose with her. "I must return to the palace, it seems," she sighed. "The light knows how they will feel about no one there to greet them. Amis, if you know where Ruark is, could you send a message for him to meet me?" Amis nodded, but Cerulea said, "You should..."